This is Fresh Air. In the 19th century, London was the capital of the largest empire the world had ever known. It was also infamously filthy. Its residents choked on soot-drenched fog, traveled down streets covered with muddy horse excrement, and drank water from the Thames River, which was thick with human sewage. Just how dirty the city was and how its citizens attempted to deal with it is the subject of the entertaining and sometimes disgusting new book, Dirty Old London, The Victorian Fight Against Filth, by Lee Jackson. Jackson has written several nonfiction and fiction books about Victorian London. He spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger.
Lee Jackson, welcome to Fresh Air. It's hard for us to imagine just how filthy the city of London was in the Victorian era. What would it be like just walking through the streets? What would you be stepping in? What would you be smelling? What was it like?
Yeah, so I think stepping in it is definitely the point. I mean, the first thing you'd notice if you stepped out onto the streets would be the mud that lined the carriageway, as it were. But of course, it wasn't really mud. Mud was something of a euphemism. It was essentially composed of horse dung. There were tens of thousands of working horses in London, and with inevitable consequences for the streets. And the Victorians never really found a really effective way of removing that, unfortunately. The air itself was generally filled with soot and smoke. It was famously said of the sheep in Regent's Park. They were still grazing sheep in Regent's Park in the mid-Victorian period, that you could tell how long they'd been in the capital by how dirty their coats were. They got increasingly from white to black over a period of days. And, you know, if you're a respectable person, you had to wash your face and hands several times during the day to make sure that you looked half decent. So you had this sort of the mud on the streets, you had the fog and the smoke in the air, you had the stench probably from blocked drains and cesspools below houses. It wasn't really a pleasant experience.
Well, you write in the 1890s that there were about 300,000 horses in the streets and producing 1,000 tons of dung a day.
Yes, I mean, and you know, imagine the sheer amount of labour that would be needed to collect that. The City of London came up with a scheme of using basically boys aged 12 to 14, whose job, they were called street orderlies, and their job was to dart between the traffic and try and scoop it up as soon as this stuff hit the streets, as it were. But it was an immense and impossible challenge. And urine, of course, from the horses was also another problem. It soaked the streets. There was an experiment in, I think, Piccadilly with wood paving in the mid-century, and it was abandoned after a few weeks because the sheer smell of ammonia that was coming from the paving was just impossible. And also the shopkeepers nearby said that, you know, this ammonia was actually discoloring their brass shop fronts as well.
So you write that cesspools weren't outlawed in London until 1855. What were the cesspools like in the city?
Well, this is the thing that's often forgotten, that, you know, London at the start of the 19th century, it was basically filled with these cesspools. There'd be brick chambers. They would be maybe about 6 feet deep, 4 foot wide, and every house would have one. They would be ideally in the back garden, away from the house, but equally in central London, in the more crowded areas, it was quite common to have a cesspool in the basement below the house. And this is, you know, above the cesspool would be where your household privy would be. And, you know, that was basically your sanitary facilities, for want of a better term. And that actually worked quite well for a little while. But then people got very interested in this new invention, the water closet. And it's often ignored that actually the water closets were initially connected to these cesspools, not the sewer system that existed in the start of the century. That was just for rainwater. And so you get water closets coming in, they're connected to cesspools, and they don't really fit because of the extra large volume of the flushing water. You get these sort of surges of waste and damp and smell. And people start getting very concerned about what's in their cesspools because the sort of stink that's rising from them in the back gardens and in their houses. The idea that this sort of stench is coming into the house, seeping through the house, and possibly bringing diseases like, say, cholera or typhoid into your home, into your family, is actually one of the great sort of driving forces of sanitary reform in the 19th century.
Who were the night soil men and what was their job?
Well, yeah, so you're quite right. You know, the cesspool would be in your back garden, it would be under your house. But eventually, the waste had to be removed. Now, actually, cesspools were built to be porous. So the liquid part of the waste was meant to just seep away into the ground. There was no knowledge of bacteriological contamination, although there was plenty of it happening. But nevertheless, yes, you have this residue of solid matter left at the end. And it was removed by so-called night soil men. This wasn't actually a sort of full-time job for people. There were often dustmen or labourers or bricklayers who made a little extra money on the side, and they would come in the middle of the night to your home And it was by law in the night, because the stench of emptying a cesspool was considered too disturbing during the day. And they would unfortunately have to clamber down into this pit and shovel out the mug, get into a wicker basket, get into a cart. And at the start of the century, that was actually reasonably productive labour, because the cart could then be taken out to the countryside and the manure could be sold to farmers. So there was actually some profit in selling things on as well.
You say that the night soil men would take the muck out and then bring it to their yard and just let it dry there, which must have created an awful stench for their neighbours.
Yes, I mean, there's these sort of complaints of... And, you know, sometimes at the start of the century, London's still relatively small. You know, it's only really 3-4 miles across, basically. And these night soil men and the people who manage them, their yards would be actually, you know, really often in just like a back street adjoining some very respectable houses. And if you look at the sort of parish records of the early 19th century, people, you know, complaining that their neighbour is, you know, got literally this mountain of human excrement building up in their backyard, which they're planning to sell on. You know? So, yes, it was horrible. And there was no easy way of dealing with it at the time. You just complain to your local vestry, your local parish authority, and hope they could persuade the person in question to do something about it.
You say that the Victorians created public toilets. How big was that a need at the time?
Well, you know, the Victorians were very keen on public health, what they called sanitary science, you know, trying to eradicate disease and dirt from London. And they introduced a massive sewer system in the mid-century. And you'd think, as part of that, you might provide some kind of facilities for the general public who had, you know, a need to use the toilet. And yet, it was a strange... long saga, basically. It's often said that the first public toilets were at the Great Exhibition, which was this sort of, you know, the first world expo, as it were, held in Hyde Park. It had 6 million visitors in a matter of months. And there were indeed public toilets set up within the exhibition. But there was a great debate after that closed as to whether London needed such facilities actually on the street. And it was tied up with notions of sort of shame and respectability. And it was particularly said that women would just be too embarrassed to enter a public toilet in the public street. This whole thing went on for basically decades, arguing about whether the capital should have such facilities.
Right. So before the Victorians got over their prudishness about female anatomy, what options were available for women?
Well, the options were very limited. I mean, if you were... very well-to-do person, if you had your own coach, you could draw the blinds and use, if you're a lady, use something called a bordeloo, which is basically a sort of an elongated sort of gravy boat. This was basically something that, you know, if you're a very respectable person, you could have this just tucked under the seat in your coach, and if you're absolutely desperate, you could do that. The middle classes were more expected to go into shops, and, you know, the idea was that if you knew a confectioner's shop or maybe your milliner's, you would just have a quiet word with the servant and say, well, can I use your facilities, you know? But for the average person, for someone of the working class who was moving about the city, there really was nowhere to go. And the idea was that basically you just sort of restrained yourself, or, you know, the back alleys of London were fairly filthy anyway. And if you lived in the slums, often the sort of the toilet facilities that were provided were basically non-existent or entirely blocked. So it wasn't unusual for cellars or back streets just to be used as sort of ad hoc toilets, unfortunately.
That's right. You say that the men had very little compunction about using the alleyways as urinals, and you describe this thing. I think you coin it as a urine deflector. What was that?
Well, it's a great invention. I was reading a very obscure early 19th century journal, and it mentioned how hostile London is to the tourist and to the visitor. And it said that even to the extent that there were, I think the phrase he used was barricados, you know, as in barricades, against relieving yourself in the street. And I wondered what that meant. I didn't take much notice of it. But now, in researching the book, I found another source which basically said the same sort of thing, that there were sort of grooved and angled bits of metal that were to prevent you urinating. I thought, what? I don't quite understand what this is about. And believe it or not, about a week after I read that, I just happened to walk through an alleyway off Fleet Street, Clifford's Inn Passage. It's a very old part of London. And I've been there 1,000 times before. I used to work around there. And along the wall were set about 45 degrees to the wall with these iron strips with grooves running down them, about 2 or 3 feet off the ground. I looked at them and I realised this was it. This was exactly what they'd been talking about. And they were there to prevent people urinating against your wall. If you had a business or a shop and you didn't want members of the public nipping into the alley around the side, you would put this groove against your wall, this sort of sloping little bit against the wall. And of course, if someone was to relieve themselves there, the slope meant that the urine fell straight into their shoes. And apparently these were all over London, and there's just this one set left on Fleet Street.
So we spent a lot of the time today talking about just how dirty London was, but how did it get so awful? I mean, is it just a case of the city growing beyond its means of controlling itself?
I think there's a great quote, I think, towards the end of the century. Someone says that basically London has sort of a village organisation still, even by the end of the 19th century. And certainly at the start, the local government of London is parochial in the sort of literal and metaphorical sense. You know, it really is parishes with their local clergymen and a couple of, you know, the sort of worthy businessmen and you know, so forth, who are actually running things at a very localised level in these sort of tiny, balkanised parts of London. There are even some landowners who obtain sort of special acts which would allow them to run particular streets or squares as separate government entities. And so London's made up of this sort of patchwork of tiny authorities. And that perhaps works okay in the Georgian period when it's still a relatively small city. But yes, as it grows, the massive immigration from the provinces, from Ireland, these sort of small bodies just can't cope with the sheer scale of the challenge, just the sheer amount of dirt and the sheer amount of rubbish that has to be moved. You know, rubbish is a great sort of logistical problem as well as sort of a public health problem. And it just becomes too much of a challenge for them. And the problem is as well, the Victorians were great believers in what we would now perhaps call small government. They didn't believe in centralisation. There was great hostility to national government coming in and telling Londoners what to do. And the idea of setting up even some kind of municipal London authority was immensely politically contentious. And this really set back any hope of cleaning London for much of the 19th century.
How did things actually get better in London? I mean, we talked a lot about how filthy it was. I mean, I think London today is not the same city. How did things improve?
Well, I mean, the Victorians did achieve something. They built the famous great sewer network of the mid-19th century, built by Joseph Bazalgette, now sort of renowned civil engineer, you know, and that did achieve a lot. It basically took away the possibility of sort of wholesale cholera epidemics in the city. Typhus and typhoid, they all were reduced. But basically, it's only until the end of the 19th century and into the 20th century that you get a sort of an effective central authority for London that you actually start to see change. London County Council is set up in 1889, and it takes decades for people to accept that the state perhaps has a role in, you know, how they manage their household, how they manage their rubbish, you know, their toilet facilities even. You know, but the state basically does intervene, and it is that idea of, you know, a sort of central authority that is actively concerned. What the Victorians would have called in a century sort of municipal socialism. And that was almost politically unacceptable at the start of the 19th century. But by the end, it was seen as just absolutely necessary. And that sort of mission to improve people's lives on a very sort of day-to-day basis was carried on basically throughout the 20th century.
Lee Jackson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lee Jackson is the author of Dirty Old London. He spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. You can read an excerpt of Dirty Old London on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers one Wikipedia editor's war against the use of one phrase. This is Fresh Air.